Imam veliko čast, da v naši sredini pozdravim gospod Erin Pizej. Verjamem, da ste vsi tisti, ki ste danes tukaj, za njo že slišali. In veste, da je ustanoviteljica prvih varnih hiš na svetu, v svetovnem merilu. In da smo jo danes povabili sem preko spleta dogodkov v okviru varuha človekovih pravic. Zato je varuh človekovih pravic tudi njen gostitelj današnji dan. Jutrišnji dan pa bo preživela z nevladnimi organizacijami. Danes je tudi nekaj priložnosti za stike z mediji, to bo seveda tudi še jutri. Današnje popovdne bi pa organizirali približno tako, da bi najprej bilo eno predavanje, potem bi bila pavza, da bi se gospa vmes malo odpočila in tudi ustregla medijem. Potem bi pa potem imeli eno razpravo, ne bom rekla okroglo mizo, ampak en panel, v katerem bi gospa Pizej rada izvedla, kako je pri nas z varnimi hišami, kako je z možnostmi pomoči za žrtve nasilja v družini, skratka, da bi se nekako izmenjali izkušnje in seveda tudi izkoristili njeno prisotnost za to, da nam kakšne stvari pojasni, ali pa na novo razloži, ali kakorkoli, da nas poduči. Gospa Pizi je tudi dovolila, da se njena predavanja snemajo in da se potem ta predavanja uporabijo v učne namene oziroma za pač namen, s katerim smo se mi danes tukaj zbrali. Tako da tisti, ki imate mikrofone, kamere ali karkoli že, se tega lahko poslužite in bomo najbolj od tega vsi na ta način odnesli še več. Kot veste, je predavanje v angleščini. V angleščini bo tudi panel oziroma razprava. Za tiste, ki bi želeli pomoč pri prevajanju, vprašanji in odgovorov, bomo to tudi naredili. Kot ste najbolj opazili, tam pri vhodnih vratih smo pri varuhu naredili eno tako mapco oziroma zložili skupaj na tako mapco, v kateri je nekaj materijalov, ki jih je gospa Pizi poslala prej in smo zdaj to razmnožili. Zraven so tudi, mislim, je še brošurca o varuhu človekovih pravic in pa mora bi biti zloženka o zagovorniku, zagovornik glas otroka. Da umestim to današnje predavanje v malo širši kontekst, je pa takole. Kot veste je danes, pa nekateri veste, da je danes na Brdu bilo srečanje, jaz ne znam francosko, ampak neki L'Enfant, ne, Europe, L'Enfant, kako se reče to, dajte mi povedati. Skratka, neki Evropa pa otroci, jaz ne znam francosko, pa izgovoriti iste besede. No, v glavnem tam smo na srečanju te delovne skupine za otroke v okviru Evrope smo predstavili naš pilotski projekt Zagovornik glas otroka in imamo tudi možnost, da o tem povemo kaj več v tistem drugem delu. Zanimivo je to, da je dejansko vsa Evropa, vsaj udeleženci današnjega srečanja, prišla do ugotovitve, da otroci ne dobivajo ustrezne zaščite v postopkih in to ni samo slovenski problem, ampak tudi evropski, ki se ga bo morala Evropa čim prej lotiti in pripraviti enotne usmerice. Tokle za ta okvir. Zdaj smo vsi pripravljeni za snemanje, vse, kar smo se dogovorili. Dobro. Ok. Ernest Pizej, so I introduced you and the context, global context, we meet here today. And the first part of our gathering will be your lecture, then a short pause, and after that a panel discussion about questions that are interesting for you or for us, and we'll try to finish with our work today about 6 p.m.
Okay.
So, floor is yours.
Thank you. If I say something and you don't understand it and you would like me to explain it again, just put your hand up, please. Well, I'm going to begin at the beginning, the history of how the first refuge, as we call them in England, They're called safe houses here in Slovenia, and America calls them shelters. But basically, how the first one came into being. I was living in London, in Chiswick, and in West London, and I, like many women with small children, had been very lonely and isolated, because my husband was in television and he wasn't home very much. And I wanted very much to have a place where women could meet with their children from all classes of society and where we could get together and work on problems in our own community. Because I knew that many women had skills that they could use even while they were at home with small children. And I had been brought up in China. I was born in China. I'd lived in the Middle East. And I was used to the big extended family life that most young women with children had in those countries. So to come back to England and suddenly find this tremendous isolation where you didn't have grandparents and uncles and aunts all living around you, I found it very lonely. So I didn't at any point intend to open a refuge, I can promise you. And if I had known what was going to happen, I think I'd have run away. So when I first opened the house, a lot of people, women came who had problems, who were shy of going to social workers, who were more comfortable to come to ordinary women who had children like themselves. And it was a little house. It had four rooms, two upstairs, two downstairs, and outside in the back garden was a little toilet and a kitchen. And we began to work. Very soon, within a matter of months, the first woman came in. Her name was Kathy. And she came up to the little office, which is on the top floor, and she took off her top, and she was blue from her neck down to her waist, where her husband, Wally, had beaten her with the leg of a chair. And she said to me, "No one will help me." And I remembered as a child, we were living in Canada at that time, standing in front of a teacher at my school, and there was blood running down my legs from a whipping that my mother had given me with an ironing cord. And I said to the teacher, "Will you help me?" And she wouldn't. They didn't interfere. So after all those years, I'd put away my childhood. I'd locked it all away. I thought something was being done for children in my state. And here I was, all those years later, I was 32 years old, and this woman stood before me and said, "No one will help." I remember going home that night. I was so angry. And I took her home with me to my own house because I couldn't leave her in that little house by herself. And then, very shortly, word got out locally that there was somewhere to go, somewhere where you would be protected. Because what had happened before is that if a woman was beaten in her house and she left home with the children, all the husband had to say was, "I want my wife and children back," and she could get no help. The police couldn't interfere. It was called a domestic. They had no right to go behind the front door. There was no laws in place at that time to protect anybody from what was seen as family violence. So I had to begin at the beginning and begin to explain to people that we had to get things changed very, very quickly. Because for me and my childhood, I had a twin sister and a brother. I reckon that because both my parents were violent, both my father and my mother, my father was a diplomat. There was no problem financially. We lived in big houses with lots of servants, but they waged war on each other and on us all our lives. And I believed that I was robbed of a childhood. I was robbed of what should be every child's right, which is a peaceful, loving, happy family. And so as soon as the women started coming in with their children, I was immediately in trouble. The local vicar, our priests, they were preaching in the churches that I was a marriage wrecker. I was encouraging women to run away from their husbands. I was encouraging. And then slowly, as more and more women came, we were packed out. In that little tiny house, women would sleep with their backs against the wall, sitting cross-legged, and their heads down, and we'd put the children on mattresses on the floor. And we refused to turn anyone away. And I always remember The house was absolutely packed one evening and the door went and I went downstairs. There was this girl standing there and she had two little children in her arms and I said, "Where have you come from?" She said, "I've come from Plymouth." Now Plymouth's the other end of London, of England. I said, "How did you hear about us?" And she said, "I heard." And then it was like a huge wave, if you can imagine. And of course, the first thing that happened was that the local borough council, who owned the little house, said, "You have no right to take these women and children in." I said, "But if I don't take them, they could die." They didn't. They said, "We will take out a warrant to arrest you and put you in jail. You are breaking the law." I was very lucky in that there was sufficiently powerful press to actually begin to make it a very, very big cause in England. So they didn't quite dare arrest me. And then I was a man came in one day and said, "What can we do to help?" And I said, "I need a really, really big house." And that was the first purpose shelter in the world for women and children and men. As soon as I opened the shelter for women, I realized there needed to be provision for men as well, because I didn't see it as a gender issue. My mother was violent. She had an appallingly violent childhood. My father was violent. They had come together and they ruined each other's lives, actually, and their children's lives. So I never saw it as a gender issue. I saw it as a family issue, a human issue. And I could see as the children came in, the children that were infected by the violence and what I called use different strategies to survive it. You often saw that the boys, internalizing their violent father's behavior, would act out the same way. Some of the girls were certainly violent, particularly if their mothers were violent. But you also saw how many of the girls became subservient and saw them cast themselves in victims' roles. And my real concern is those were the girls that would go on and create violent relationships. So there were two problems, and this I've brought you the comparative study which I wrote on the first 100 women that came into my refuge, because I was faced with two immediate problems, apart from all the other problems. But one was this. The women coming in who are innocent victims of their partner's violence, by accident, anybody could get involved in a relationship not realizing what can happen. And then before they know where they are trapped. Either by because they're pregnant, they have children, because they love the man. I'm talking about men now and women in the refuge. Because they love the man and they want him to change. These women, once they make that decision to get out, they recognize that they need to prioritize their children, the safety and future of their children. They can actually see that their children are becoming violent and dysfunctional. And they will come into a refuge, and they will grieve, and it'll break their heart. But they will make it out. They will make a new life for themselves and their children. The women that are closest to my heart are the women that are like my mother. She was orphaned and terribly badly beaten by a stepmother and abandoned and betrayed, and she herself was incapable of loving anybody at all, actually. It's a tragic life she led. It was a bitter, miserable life. And my feeling was that in those days there was no help. There was nowhere she could go. You couldn't admit that you needed help. So when the women started coming to the refuge, the social workers would say, "I can't do anything with her. It's no good you looking after her. She'll just go back to him. And if she doesn't go back to him, she'll find another man who's just equally as violent." And I'd say, if that's the case, then I've failed. We have failed to give her what she needs to help her break that cycle of violence. Not just for her sake, but also for her children's sake. So Chiswick employed both men and women. The first bit of money I had, I employed a good, exceptionally gentle, lovely man to work with the children. And then always the staff were half men and women. And because there were no training programs, there was nothing in those days. There was actually no literature on domestic violence. There was a very little known about battered children, but mostly in the medical field. It really was there was nothing. So I wrote a book called Scream Quietly or the Neighbours Will Hear. And this was a book, was actually said by one of my husbands to my mother. Her name was Jean Duffin. And she said to me, "My husband said, scream quietly or the neighbours will hear." And I said, "Can I use that title for my book?" And she said the other thing he said to her was, because there was a terrible sound of battering going on down the road, and she said, look at that. And he said, that's disgusting. Someone's beating his wife. And she said to him, but you beat me. And he turned around and he said to her, but that's different. You're my wife. It's the understanding where a violent person is coming from. Because you can't do anything to make those changes if all you do is keep pointing your finger at people, telling them they're violent, they're no good, they're useless. What we created was a huge therapeutic program for mothers and children and any of the men who wanted to actually get involved with us. The illegal side of what we did was basically because we could not rehouse any of the families that came to us, because they came from all over England, and our local borough said, they're not my responsibility, we're not going to look after them. So I don't know if you do this in Slovenia, but in those days, in the 1970s, there was a very big squatting movement. Now, squatting means when you take over a house that belongs to the government and it's empty and it isn't being used, you move in. And we used to move in 28 mothers and children, lots of mothers and children, into great big beautiful houses. You put your notice on the door because you move in at night. And when the police see that, they know that they can't evict anybody from those houses. It's called squatting. So we actually rehouse mothers and children by creating these huge communities, what we call second stage houses. Because women, many women who were very vulnerable, women who had been born into violence, house homes, had a childhood of violence and sexual abuse, had been abused by men in their lives and had children with them now, needed a long time to heal. It wasn't a question just saying, oh, come in for 30 days, then we'll put you here. You can't do that. So Chiswick became a big therapeutic family, and the women who came into what was we called the big house could stay as long as they liked. Some stayed 3 or 4 years in the crisis centre before they moved into the second stages. But by this point, Chiswick itself, the mother house, we had houses right the way across England, and we had a huge hotel in Richmond. It had been empty for years and had 47 private suites. So we squatted that one night, and a huge amount of this new community was formed. And it was very safe, because one of the cruelest things you can do is to take somebody out of a very violent, dysfunctional relationship, offer them 30 days or a couple of months of care, and then dump them out in the community again. It doesn't work. And then people say, yes, but she went back. Yes, yes. If you don't give her the support she needs, and the understanding, if you don't form the relationships to hold her while she's going through this tremendous crisis, to give her a chance, because apart from anything else, every child coming in to a refuge on the run from a violent relationship is already damaged. And you can't simply rehouse all that damage and leave her to deal with it. The children needed therapeutic programs. They needed the men who understood them and could help them. The mothers needed the time and the space even to just be able to share and to talk to each other. The strongest part of our community was the relationships that the women formed with each other. Because those of you who've come from violent homes, and there will be some of you in here, not just me, know how isolated you are as a child. You can't bring people home because the children would be frightened of what goes on behind your front door. You know that you are going to be isolated. You can't talk to people. You don't tell people what's going on, what your father does or your mother does. It's secret. And that's where to find a community where you're loved and accepted, even if some of your behaviour is unacceptable, and you know that you can learn other ways, and there are people there to help you, was part of what happened at Chiswick. Very soon, the radical feminist movement in England and in America, they were looking for a cause. And I kept saying, this is not a gender issue. Men and women can be affected by domestic violence. Their attitude was, and in a sense, they hijacked the entire discussion. And the argument was that all men are potentially violent, all men are potential rapists because of the history of patriarchy. Now, for me, looking at the children who are subjected to domestic violence, I could not see an argument that only the boys are affected by the violence, Absolutely not. And the girls. And many of the girls were violent themselves. So I always saw it as a human problem, a problem that's been with us since man probably first walked this earth. The cruelty, that the damage that a childhood subjected to these terrible, terrible events. The most important part for me was not just the physical violence, because bones heal and bruises fade. What seemed to create the greatest rage and the biggest damage was sexual abuse in childhood, in early childhood. And the highest percentage of the children coming in had been molested, if not by parents, by other members of the family. Because we're talking about big dysfunctional families. It isn't as though just the two people are involved. You've got grandparents who are violent. You've got parents who are violent. You've got children who are violent. You've got children who are violent to parents and children who are violent to elderly. Elder abuse is the most secret of all problems in our country. We do not talk about elder abuse. We're only just after 40 years being realistic about domestic violence, because those people working in the courts, the first move I had to make was to educate the police. To actually, and they, I must say, the police in England are now very, very well trained. And they have the right, if a phone call comes in, either from a man or a woman, they will go immediately and to the house. And they will arrest, they have powers of arrest. They can now arrest who they witness at the time is being violent. This can cause a problem in that I'm afraid you've got to really accept that majority of domestic violence relationships are mutual. Remember what I said. There are people who are innocent victims of their partner's violence. That is not mutual. They want to get out, and with help and support, they will. The people that we really have to care about and we really have to look after and think about are people who themselves have come from violent and dysfunctional families and are actually repeating this pattern of violence that goes through generations. When I sit down with a woman and we do this questionnaire, we look back as far as she can remember of her own family and also of his, and you can see it just coming down. The exciting thing is that some people are transcenders. For some reason, something happened, and they managed to look at the life that they were leading as a child and turn their backs on it, and they do not become violent. We don't even think about those. We don't even study. What is it that can rescue a child? For me, I was new from a very, very early age that I was passionately loved by God. And even though my mother was never able to love me and made it very clear, she used to say I was born to be hanged. I knew that there was a way that people could live together and would not have to repeat these dreadful patterns that my mother and father were repeating. So once the police started to be able to take, and we got the legal situation changed, the next tackling was really to do with the law. Now, those of you that are working in matrimonial law probably know how difficult it is. That in majority of divorces, all divorce is damaging to children. There's no such thing as a good divorce. The people that you most love in the world are going to split up. And the majority of children feel that they're being abandoned. But from the point of view of domestic violence, normal people can prioritize their children when they divorce. They can actually put their children first. People who have personality disorders, who come from dysfunctional and violent families, aren't capable of prioritizing. What tends to happen, it becomes a vicious, vicious, dangerous battle. And one of the problems is that the law is not actually based on the understanding that in some cases the courts are added danger to the family, to the woman, particularly with her children. One of our problems in the early days, it's still a problem, I don't know what happens here in Slovenia, and I'm sure you'll tell me, you have to go to the High Court in the Strand with your mother and stand in a room not much bigger than this with a man that's tried to kill her. And that's for a start, is an enormously cruel thing to do to anybody. And yes, he will behave while you're in court, but as in the case of Mrs. Easy, as she came out of the court, I had warned and warned and warned the court and the court security that he was very, very dangerous. And as usual, nobody really listened. And as she came out down the front steps, he was there, he was waiting for her, and he stabbed her in the neck with a nail file. And he went to jail for 2 years. And then he was out again. Now, in those cases, the idea of a court case resolving that kind of dangerous relationship is naive. Mr. Easy had a severe personality problem. He will always be a danger to women. And we have to recognize that and stop always talking about level playing fields. It can't be a level playing field. There is a huge difference between two people who have a quarrelsome marriage and they argue and they fight and they decide to divorce, but they can remain rational and sane. And the kind of domestic violence that I deal with, where the person concerned, sometimes it's both, but let's say in this case it's the man who's violent, possessive, morbidly jealous, to put his back up against a wall in court in front of people is to make him a very, very dangerous person. Because you're not going to be there at night. The police aren't going to be there when he finally catches up with her. In those days, the Crown Prosecution couldn't bring a prosecution unless the woman herself was willing to prosecute. So there again, she was put in a position where she knew perfectly well that by going ahead with a prosecution, he is going to know that she has put it in this situation. So what did they do? Crown prosecutors thought, oh, we know what to do. She doesn't have to prosecute him. We'll prosecute him, whether she wants us to or not. Well, anybody in this field of work, sure, anybody could see, again, where's the Crown Prosecutor at night? Is he standing outside her door to defend her? No. She comes out, he comes out, and she's on her own again. It's trying to get people to understand the extent of what a really violent relationship means. Where you know that this man has a history. I mean, I lost some of my women. They're dead. One of them, I tried to explain to the court. It was a private house. The judge gave all these restraining orders, and I kept saying, in certain cases, restraining orders are a complete waste of time. Somebody who has a severe personality disorder does not even begin to accept or understand rules that everybody else lives by. Yes, you can put them in jail, but they'll come out madder and more dangerous than ever. Judge wouldn't listen. I've taken out the restraining orders, we've notified the police, this is the law of the land. If she doesn't go back into the house, I will put it on the market and it will be sold. And I remember saying to Olive, she had 6 kids, don't, please, whatever you do, you know he's dangerous. He's told you he'll kill you, don't go back. And Olive said, I've spent all my life earning the money, because he never earned any, to make this beautiful house for my children. I have to go back. And she did go back, and that night he got in and he stabbed her to death. Courts don't say they're sorry. Judges never admit they're wrong. So, when you're working at that level, you have to, and one of the problems is we need to have international understanding that we cannot have a radical feminist, not feminist, because we all believe in equality for women, but the radical feminist attitude that men have to be excluded from this problem. Men can't work in refuges in other countries. Men can't sit on the board. Boys over 12 can't go into refuges. We can't do that. We have to all agree that both men and women need to work together on this problem. They need to come together. The courts, we need to educate. We need to educate the courts. We need to educate that mediation is a much safer method than actually dragging people in and out of courts. Apart from anything else, quite a lot of the people involved who are very violent themselves find the court a wonderful theatre for their drama. And you notice that the same figures going again and again and again obsessively back to court. and everybody gets involved. A woman will come in, you'll see she's got social workers, she's got a psychiatrist, she's got doctors, she's got hospitals, she's got therapists, she's got all sorts of people around her involved in this dramatic violent relationship that she's in, all exhausted and all angry with her. Because they keep putting these structures on her. They keep saying, leave him, leave him. It's quite simple. All you have to... It is not a simple matter to leave addictive relationships. And it, I began to realise, towards about 20 years on, as I walked, watched women going back and back and back, then I read... Freud said 100 years ago, he said, at some point, all human emotions will be found in chemicals of the brain. And of course he's right. What is it, falling in love? It's endorphins in the brain. That's how you fall in love. Strong, powerful, addictive parts of your brain. And I think that we will eventually find that you can be as addicted to a relationship as you can to drugs or alcohol. And I've often said to a woman, think of him as your heroin pusher. If you can stay away long enough, you'll be able to go cold turkey and break it. But every time, as one woman wrote to me, she died, she said, you know, as long as I never hear his voice again, she said, he's like the Pied Piper. She said, I can stay away from him. Her name was Lindsay. She was one of the first women that came into the refuge with two little boys. He was terribly, terribly cruel, her husband. And she eventually came in with her two boys. And she was the mainstay of the refuge. She was just a beautiful person. And she did very, very well. And unfortunately, I went away on holiday. And her case had come up in court. And our solicitor had made a mistake, because we got permission from the court that the name of the refuge was never on any of the papers. We just handed the address up to the judge so no one else saw it. But the solicitor made a mistake and left our address. And unbeknown to me, because I was away at the time, he was ringing her at night. And then she went back. And then she died. And the note she'd left to me said, if I hear his voice again. The addiction overpowered her. And then I tried to get the boys because I didn't want them to have to go into care, but I couldn't find them. And years later, when I was living in America and running a refuge there, I got a letter from a boy because I'd written a novel called In the Shadow of the Castle, and it is dedicated to Lindsay. And he said, I read that book. Is that my mother? And of course it was Lindsay. And it was just wonderful to find Adam again and to be able to tell him about his mother and what a special person she was. And the work that we do in refuges is vital. It's vital in that one of the problems is domestic violence is like an elephant in the room. Everybody has a bit of it, but nobody sees the whole picture. And if when you're working directly with a woman, for instance, which is my work, and she has had a tremendously violent life, and you go back with her, back to the very beginnings of the first memories that she ever has of her family, and what happened, and where, and you walk with her, it's internal work, because you're walking through the years and years, and you're stopping and letting her find, it's like a jigsaw, putting that jigsaw together, of what really happened, because a lot of it is locked away. I often think people coming to me are like icebergs. I can see this much of them. But under here is this huge amount of damage that drives people. It's like they're driving on a bus with their eyes shut, because the bus is doing the driving, and you need to help them open their eyes so they can take control of their lives and their relationships. And that was the work that we were doing within the refuge. So you had your crisis refuge at Chiswick. You then had a home for indefinite stay. These are women who were on court orders, who otherwise would have gone to jail, and their children would have gone into care. I could negotiate with the courts and with probation officers that if they came into my project and stayed with me and worked with their children on themselves, then they didn't have to go to jail. And we had one thing, this lovely woman, she had two little children called Cherubim and Seraphim. They were gorgeous. And she came in because she'd been living on a big housing estate, and she'd stabbed her husband in the neck, and in the carotid artery, and he died. And his family were determined to catch her, and they would have killed her if they'd found her. They're a very big, violent family. Anyway, when the truth came out, she had killed him, not in self-defense, as she said, but because he was going to leave her for another woman. And she had big abandonment issues. And the court agreed. So she stayed with us for 5 years in a second stage house. And then she moved on and she became a social worker. And what a better prognosis to be able to have her living in the community with her two children, so that she was able to study and create a future for herself, than to do what we do these days, which is we just lock people up in prisons, as though somehow that was going to resolve the situation. It doesn't. My vision of a safe house had been what I was building at Chiswick. This is a prolonged community care with a therapy for those who need it. Not everybody needed it. For a lot of women who are innocent victims, they just needed support, legal help, and whatever. And then they could move on quite happily. But for a large part of the women coming in, they needed long-term help. At the same time, it was a question of educating the community, the lawyers, the social workers, right the way through all the caring agencies, that it isn't enough to simply say, oh, battered women need a refuge. Or, you know, her problem is she needs to be rehoused. Well, she can always leave him. And if she doesn't leave him, well, then we're going to get angry with her and punish her. Because that's really what was happening. Even now, the difficulty in England is that if a woman is in a relationship with a violent man and doesn't leave, social services' only recourse is usually to take the children into care and leave her with the violent relationship. That isn't what we should be doing. We should be mothering a mother so she can mother her children. We should be offering not just a safe place for people who need it. We need to offer a very safe place for women and men, for people who have no second chance. When you read the histories of many of the women coming into the refuge, it is no wonder that they're violent and traumatized. Absolutely no wonder. We don't have at the moment what happens in most refuges. Any woman with drinks problem can't come in. Any woman who's a drug addict can't come in. They're filtered out. And these are the people that we most need to get to, because what chance have the children got if you're going to start filtering out the mothers who most need the care and attention? So it isn't a question of just saying, well, we'll have a safe house for people that we like and are nice and grateful and gentle. That isn't what we need to be doing. And we need to be concentrating right the way across the board. There needs to be a huge difference in how we handle these cases in court. Vast majority, 90% of cases can go to court and a resolution will come. It might be bitter, it might be angry, it might take a lot of mediating, but those will actually resolve themselves. The cases we're talking about are the 10%. Where basically one or both parents have a severe personality disorder. They have to be dealt with quite differently. So what we did is we had these solicitors come into the refuge to see their clients. So we took it away from going to offices. We brought it back into within the family structure. Then the social worker and the various people could meet and discuss with the woman what it is that she wanted. Then it was a question of visiting the father of a man, and negotiating with him. In most cases, we were very successful, even with quite violent men, to negotiate a future for him to be able to see his child or children, if the children were willing to see him. And we have contact centres, which you probably have social centres here. So he could at least not be immediately cut off from his children. But it was put very, very clearly, if he was the perpetrator, that any behaviour on his part that was inappropriate or a repeat of any form of violence, he would then have to forfeit his children. And it worked. It worked, because what couldn't work and will never work is where he has constant access to his partner. because it doesn't give her a chance to build a life away from him, and she lives in fear of what he'll do next. Contact centres, properly run and supervised, are a very good solution to the war that is in the family. The other part is more and more in England we're trying to mediate, because unfortunately, as you know, the legal setup is adversarial. This solicitor fights for him and this solicitor fights for her, and then you get four people fighting, not just two. So more and more it mediates. And so we used to mediate right down to where all the agreements were made, and then we'd go into court when both sides had come to an agreement. I say this, but I have to remind you that in some cases where the man, in my experience, was so violent and so dangerous, the only answer was to disappear her and the children very, very far away, change her name, change all her details, so that he could never find her again. Because two women a week are killed in England, one man. That's a lot of people dying because people get it wrong. Time and time again, all the signs are there that it's going to happen. All the signs. And everybody goes on ignoring it, and then somebody's dead. I was talking to the sister of a man who was murdered by his partner. He'd called the police 40 times. This is 2 weeks ago. 40 times he'd called the police. And the police had come. They had taken her away on several occasions. But she always got out. She always was let back into the family. Because the children involved. The children wanted their mother. He left and the children would cry and he'd go back. Which is a very typical violent situation. But they didn't recognize that she was potentially a killer, and she did, she killed him. The case will come up in September, and you have fatherless children now. Without any treatment, she'll be sitting in Holloway, which is where she is now, with no treatment. What are the chances of it happening again? Fairly high. It is a subject that most people don't want to talk about. There's a huge amount of denial involved in domestic violence. You don't know. I mean, I had a judge who was one of the worst judges we ever had and would find against my mother's every single time. It so happened, I discovered, that he lived in Richmond, which is quite near where our refuge was. His wife, he used to lock her up in the bedroom. It was an old house, and he'd slide the food under the door. He'd keep her in there for days. She had a slop bucket to use as a toilet. He's sitting there in judgment. Because we don't have any profiling. So you never know who you're dealing with. You never know. You're sitting at a dinner table. Is that a bruise on that person's face? What's going on? If we're serious about the figures of one in four women at some time have experienced domestic violence, and it's one in six men are the official figures, and you've got the latest figures from the British Crime Survey in here, then there's far too much domestic violence around. It's dangerous, and it's not getting better, because this is my theory, at least 60 years ago, the family was extended. Children had aunts, uncles, great aunts, other places to go, other people to influence what was happening. As family life broke down, and I don't know about your politics in Slovenia, but in the 70s, it was a very fashionable thing to say that marriage was a dangerous place for women and children. That the new family unit in the 70s was going to be mothers and children, and fathers were going to be disenfranchised. Now, this became, to an extent, public policy. As you know, we have the highest rate of single-parent mothers. We have the highest rate of pregnancies, underage pregnancies. We have almost a total destruction of the family in our society. It was a great comfort to go and work in Italy, outside Siena, for 6 years, and to be back where family life was still very strong, where there were alternatives, where it was most interesting. In the village, I didn't ever have to call the guardia. I basically could just go to the various grandmothers in the big families, and it would get sorted out. Families still took care of each other. If a daughter packed up her child and went back to mum, dad would be there and the brothers and the uncles. Not like it is in England. Not like it is where when she is thrown out or she's a prisoner in her own house, there's no way, she's not near any of her family. There aren't families that stay together now. All the rehousing, we have huge amount of social housing that I don't think you have here. But they're all very small then for nuclear families. There's no room for an extra person. There's no room for grandparents. So as our society spreads out, if you are with a violent mother or father, that's it. You're stuck as a child. And my feeling is that we owe it. We owe it to children. It should be enshrined in a human's rights, the right to live in a warm, loving, peaceful family. There's an awful lot of work to do all over the world, but for us in England, we need to actually separate out. We now have domestic violence courts that actually specialise, family courts that specialise in domestic violence. They're quick, they're much better than actually lumping everything in together. We need more training. The difficulty is many of the magistrates who make the decisions aren't properly trained. They don't, again, understand when they have people coming up in front of them again and again and again. They tend to make very snap decisions. One of the major problems is that a woman will come in and say, he's terribly dangerous, he's terribly violent, I have to have all these orders to make sure he stays away. They'll give her all the orders that she needs to keep him away. Next thing they know, he's back in. She comes back again, and the orders go out again. And gradually, this instead of saying, look, you have a problem in that you are not keeping him out. You need help in understanding why you cannot leave this man who is so dangerous to you. What tends to happen is another order is taken out, and each time the court interferes in that sense in the family without understanding what they're doing, they create even more violence. So, in a sense, we need the kind of people understanding. And I wrote a book called Prone to Violence. This is about 1982. And this was a book about the work I did with the violent families that came into Chiswick, the mothers and children. And in it, I was discussing exactly what I'm telling you now. It was so important that when a woman comes in, and she's so confused about who she is, what she's doing. She's frightened because she's left. She isn't sure that she has a future on her own. She's never lived on her own. Very often they go straight from violent, dysfunctional parents to violent, dysfunctional relationships. And here for the first time, she's put her foot out and she's trying to really make a break. That's when you need to put everything you have into helping her, into holding her until such time she can actually find the courage to say, I want to stop. I want this life that so far has been so painful and so tragic. I want a new vision of how I can live. And that does come with people who are willing to spend that time with her and to help her with her children, and particularly to understand the needs of the children. It isn't just that a child will come in and hate the violence, and if it's his father, for instance, there's also a terrible residue of bitterness in children because the mother didn't leave. And they will hold it against her because for a child, your mum is the one who's supposed to protect you. And in this case, she didn't. Often, not only do, as you know, not only do the women get beaten, but so do the children. It's a huge subject, domestic violence. I believe passionately that peace on this earth has to begin behind the front door. Children born into violent, dysfunctional families, statistically, apart from anything else, tend to repeat the pattern. It is a cycle of violence that goes on generation after generation. And the work of all of you in this field is to help whoever's trapped in that cycle to break out and to change their lives to where they can enjoy the things in this world that are very beautiful and heartfelt, and the love of children who aren't ruined and destroyed. I had a little child that was kidnapped by two women. She eventually ended up in my care, and she was 6 when she came to me. She was almost bald where her hair had fallen out with the stress, and she had a rigid stomach muscles where she'd been hit so often that it was like a washboard. And she'd had more sex than I had when she was 6 years old. And that was one of the hardest jobs I've ever had, because Children can recover. I've told you, bones will heal and bruises will fade. But to destroy a child's innocence, and no wonder they say better a millstone hang round your neck, because once the child has lost that innocence, it requires enormous amount of therapy and work to bring that child to a position where they can re-experience what it is to be a child. There were many of those cases when I was in Santa Fe, New Mexico, where I went after I left England. There was a huge amount of pedophilia in that particular city in 1982 because it was very lawless. People would get to Santa Fe, particularly pedophiles, and the thing I began to realize is that they weren't just isolated pedophiles, they were actually what I used to call nests, pedophiles who got together and shared their children. And that work is probably the hardest ever, but it has to be done. Children who are born into these families, they must be rescued. And unfortunately, to be honest with you, they have to be taken away. There's only chance for those children is to actually leave those families. There is, far as I can see, I've never come across a pedophile who has ever, ever admitted to doing anything that they would even begin to admit is not right. At the moment, I do a lot of travelling. I went just last year to Bahrain to open the first refuge ever in an Arab country for Arab women. And that was fascinating because no one had ever, ever talked about domestic violence or about sexual abuse publicly in Bahrain or anywhere else in the Arab world. And it was heartwarming that men came as well, not just women, and many different type of women. Bahrain is one of the most liberal states, but there's still no contraceptive, there's still no abortion, there's still a very, very strict Sharia law. And there are many problems there that we don't have here. But the first refuge is open. They had 300 people they helped last year, and two men. And it was wonderful to just, there was a room like this, it was just standing room only, and women getting together, and the force of them talking to each other, and actually experiencing, and there was a huge joy in the power that women felt. And you know what's going to happen in the Arab world? It isn't NGOs coming in that are going to make the difference. It's the women in their country making it different for them. Because one of the things that they were saying is it's very hard for them, because they tend to get a lot of non-governmental organizations coming from the West and saying, this is what you should do, this is what you should do. And they don't want that. They know what they need to do, and they want to do it themselves. And I must say, having spent all my life in England, when I was running the refuge for 12 years, packed to go to jail, because that's what they kept trying to do. It went from the county court to the High Court in the Strand, where I lost, and then we went up to the House of Lords, where I was found guilty. Then I was taken back to the magistrate's court, and the magistrate said, if you take anybody else in, you will go to jail. And as I got back to the front door, there was a woman there with two little boys, and she said, can I come in? And I said, oh, of course you can come in. When I was in Bahrain, there, the Queen of Bahrain came, wonderful woman, to actually open the refuge there. And I thought, well, at least one country has got it right. At the very top, the Queen and everybody else involved has taken this on as something that Bahrain needs to do. And I want to hear that Slovenia feels the same way, that domestic violence, that violence within the family, that the children who have no choice, for once, right the way across Slovenia, there should be no one cowering behind a front door, man or woman or children, bullied, terrorized, and beaten. They should know that they can get up and there is somewhere they can go, somewhere that will be safe, and somewhere where they can have a safe house. And that's my great hope, that as we all get together and talk and share, that it becomes possible that we have a zero tolerance for domestic violence. We will never eradicate it because this is an imperfect world. But we can promise ourselves that where we find it, each individual will want to do something about it. Thank you.